All right. So just to note, this is a public meeting that, as I just mentioned, is being recorded as of 12:34, and it is going to be posted on our COVID-19 vaccination response website. As you may or may not have heard, Stephanie is unfortunately not able to join us at the start of this call because of several competing priorities. But she will hopefully be able to hop on at the end of the call. Thank you for your flexibility with that. And I wanted to open up the meeting to Stuart or Carolyn for any updates that either one of you would like to share.
Sure. Is Carolyn on the call or?
Actually, it looks like I don't see her in yet.
So we have had a couple of, obviously on Monday we stood the state started administering the vaccine, and we've gotten directions as regard to 1A population right now, the healthcare workers, long-term care facilities, and so on, getting the vaccine. And we've been following that in terms of barriers, working towards seeing what vaccine hesitancy there may be, both on the clinician side as well as on the patient side. And then with regards to vaccine hesitancy on the clinician side, we, along with a number of members of the Immunize Virginia Coalition, have set up a survey which has been sent out over the past week or so. And we've gotten about 300 responses right now. And we'll probably complete the survey at the end of the week, and then we'll be able to tabulate to look at the data and see and get some results as far as looking at clinician vaccine hesitancy. I know the Virginia Department of Health is doing something similar as well and is looking at focus groups and again looking at identifying vaccine hesitancy. So that's a lot of what we've been discussing right now, is pushing this survey through and looking at clinician hesitancy. I know also that as, and I don't know if this is it going to be in our purview or not, looking at barriers. Just wanted to mention that we have been talking across a number of formats in terms of trying to get to see whether outpatient practices and outpatient facilities, non-hospital facilities, can have can be able to administer the vaccine and have access to administration of the vaccine. And that's something that can be discussed as well. I know we're early in the process right now, and the vaccine has been distributed to hospitals and healthcare facilities right now. But again, we've been, like I said, raising the issue across a number of formats. So that's pretty much what I have. If there are any questions or issues that you want to want me to discuss, I'm happy to do that. And I'll stop here and look for further instructions as what you want me to say or
Okay. Yeah. Does anyone have any questions for Stuart? All right. If there are no questions, I'm going to turn it over to Kristen, who is going to be sharing some updates on Stephanie's behalf.
Hi everyone, this is Kristen Collins here. I'm going to apologize in advance. I just got this material pretty recently, and I'm definitely not as well versed as Stephanie, but I'll do my best to give her update for you all as far as what's going on the vaccine unit within the Department of Health. So the first thing I just want to provide the update on is training. I just want to let you know we have a training branch within the vaccine unit. And they have been working on building out material for healthcare personnel. And that is on the healthcare personnel section of our vaccine website. And I'll ask Andrea, I'll put her on the spot and just ask if she can just provide a link to you all for that website. And then you can just look for the healthcare personnel if you're not already familiar. There is extensive training being developed and placed there. The other piece is that CDC and Pfizer have provided many training opportunities, and that started over the past weekend and they're ongoing through this week. We also have that information available on our website. We expect that Moderna will do the same once their EUA is approved. They will start likely providing those training materials, and we will make those available to you as soon as we have them. The other piece that I want to give you an update on, you may have heard of these expert panels for healthcare personnel that are being put on. These have been moderated with panelists. So far, we've received good feedback. We have well-respected subject matter experts and providers. There was one last night that was recorded. The recording will be placed up on our website as well. So far, we're hearing good feedback from the event, and there will be more of those in the future. Again, that information is located on our website for upcoming training and panel events. The other piece that I'll give an update on, as far as, and actually I think this is another bullet, but I'm just gonna do it all in one lump because that's how Stephanie gave it to me. But again, I can try to talk through any of these if there's questions. But so as far as the long-term care facility, federal pharmacy partnership, I think there's a piece on the agenda today about consent from this population. So there is, CDC does have a consent form for the long-term care facility population, and that's because we want to ensure that the population is obviously not being coerced in any way to get the vaccine. So the pharmacies, the CVS and the Walgreens that are working with those different facilities are reaching out in advance to them to send the request forms, since they may require contact from persons who are making decisions on behalf of the residents. The other piece I'll mention about long-term care facilities is that the VDH long-term care facility task force has sent some talking points out yesterday, and that they're meeting again on Thursday, and that an expert panel for long-term care facility providers will be on December 21st, and that information is on our website. Just to continue with some of the other operational updates from the Virginia Department of Health, as far as it pertains to pharmacies, we're working with pharmacies to figure out ways that we can partner in statewide partnership with them to help administer the vaccine to targeted groups based on the various prioritizations. We sent a survey out last week, gathering interest from various pharmacies throughout the Commonwealth. And now we are working to get agreements in place with pharmacies that indicated they have interest and have completed the CDC enrollment process. I think Stephanie indicated we've been receiving some questions about pharmacies, and we're going to likely hold a two one-hour sessions this week to help answer questions from pharmacies. As far as it pertains to hospitals, we continue to partner with the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association, VHHA, and make sure the hospitals that we and the VHHA host weekly calls. The initial doses, likely you all know, were distributed geographically to diverse populations throughout our health systems in the Commonwealth. And as Stuart mentioned, they were received on Monday and Tuesday. And the pre-planning for those decisions of where to distribute the vaccine were based on sites with ultra-cold storage capacity. And those doses will go directly to the health system healthcare personnel. So as it pertains to non-health system healthcare personnel, the local health districts are working now to come up with their plans and have discussions with their health systems to determine who's going to vaccinate this population. We're working to have this done, obviously, in a timely manner. So we're asking that providers contact their local health district to ensure that healthcare personnel are engaged in these opportunities within their area. Just for y'all's awareness, as it pertains to preparation for other priority groups, i.e. essential workers and critical infrastructure. So the process that's set in place is the Virginia Unified Command developed this following process as it relates to COVID-19 vaccine, whereas the FDA first obviously has to approve the vaccine, and then ACIP makes recommendations. If there is sufficient vaccine to cover the entire priority group that they recommend, then we will ship directly to the designated vaccinators to administer. If there is not, then the vaccine unit within the Department of Health will draft a protocol, elicit comments from the Vaccine Advisory Committee, which is you all, and provide that to the Virginia COVID-19 Unified Command's Virginia Disaster Medical Advisory Committee, the VDMAC. And that group was established last spring to make decisions about scarce resources, includes public health, healthcare, ethicists, and representatives of the health equity work group. I think you likely have already heard a lot about VDMAC. So as far as population 1B, phase 1B, we are awaiting recommendations from ACIP. We expect them to meet this weekend. And once they make those recommendations, we will carry out that process that I just described. I think that's all I have on the operational side. I'm not sure if Todd Fouts has been able to join us to potentially give an update about the communications work that's been in place, and particularly this Immunize Virginia healthcare personnel survey. Todd, are you on?
Hey, Kristen, Jacqueline is on for Todd.
Ah, perfect. Are you able to give that update?
Sure. So as Stuart mentioned, we are working with the Immunize Virginia team, Carolyn Moneymaker, John Ring, and their team on the survey that they just put out. As Stuart mentioned, it did go out on December 10th. They have about 300 responses. So they are going to be sharing their findings with us on that survey. We then in January are doing some virtual focus groups. So we are going to be taking the findings that they discover in their most recent survey and kind of working with those and filling any gaps and holes with the focus groups that we are doing virtually beginning in January. So we are working very closely with their team. And then does anyone have any additional questions on that survey or focus groups? Okay. Well, we're working very closely with their team to make sure that there's no holes or gaps in anything that either of our teams are doing. Just jumping on to what Kristen mentioned about the recent panel events that are happening, just a reminder, there is a virtual town hall happening tonight. It is streaming, it's going to be live broadcast and streaming on about seven stations throughout the state. So just want to make sure that you guys are all aware of that event happening. I know that there is a flyer on the main page of the VDH website speaking to it. We have five panelists that are joining, and it's going to be an hour long. Again, it's tonight at 7 p.m., live broadcast and streaming on about seven stations throughout the state of Virginia. We also have an SMT, a satellite media tour coming up on Friday, the 18th. Dr. Oliver will be on in the morning, and then in the afternoon, we have a Spanish-focused one that will be happening on Telemundo and several other Spanish stations. And that will be with Marvin Figueroa. So that will be happening the afternoon of Friday, December 18th. And then just from another communication standpoint, we are working on putting together a toolkit for the local health districts. We are currently working on where it's going to be housed, but we are putting that together for them to be able to have access to current and up-to-date information that they are then able to pass out to their local health districts specifically. Currently, we're working on about a dozen different fact sheets. We are working on some shareables and flyers for social media that they'll be able to use and incorporate into their local health district communications that they are sending out. But again, we're working on a place where we can house all of this information and they can have easy access to it as they're working within their local areas. So we are hoping to have that really all put together by end of this week. So we will keep everyone in communication when that is up and running. Any questions?
This is Terry Morgan with the Virginia Board for People with Disabilities. I have a question and a comment. I'm excited that you all are working on a toolkit and some fact sheets and giving consideration to ensuring those fact sheets use plain language, common language, that they're accessible, in particular to people with disabilities who may use screen readers, and that they meet the accessibility guidelines.
Yeah. Yes. So we, as far as the readability portion, we are putting everything that we developed through a literacy readability check to make sure that it is using plain language and adjusting where needed. So that is happening on our end. We are also working with a company on a 508 compliance on the pieces that we are creating as well. Some of these pieces, since we are providing them as PDFs, we're looking to create, you know, a quick best practices for them when they are then sharing these pieces out on their end, knowing that, you know, if they're posting their own, social posts, that they make sure to, you know, keep those best practices in consideration so that everyone will have access to them.
Okay, thank you. And sometimes, you know, plain language is, you know, something that's certainly needed, but also, if there are some communications that could even maybe include photos that demonstrate what's being communicated, more of a visual communication for some folks, that might be helpful.
Yeah, a lot of the pieces that we're creating include visuals, knowing that, some of this information really does get into depth. So we're trying to really make it accessible and understandable by, you know, the general public, which we know hits around a fifth grade reading level. But knowing that, you know, making these visually interesting so that people can understand at a quick first glance kind of what we're talking about and, make it more easily understandable by the general public.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Any other questions? All right. Kristen, did you have any questions on your end?
No questions for me. So I think we can move to item four, which would essentially just bring it up to the work group members, the sub work group members for brainstorming. Are there any other barriers or gaps that we can provide for related to communications and messaging?
Hi, this is Lucy from the ARC of Northern Virginia. I put this question in the chat too, but I'm getting lots of questions from people with developmental disabilities and their families around the messaging piece, because a lot of folks with developmental disabilities use long-term care, Medicaid, live in congregate facilities, but they are unclear, as am I, about whether or not they are included in the long-term care facility population, and if their staff who work in these congregate facilities caring for them are considered essential workers. And so I can push information out to them, but those terms aren't clear enough for them to figure out whether or not they're included.
Thanks, Lucy. I will bring that question back to Stephanie, and we will send the answer out to all of the work group members to make sure everyone's on the same page. I will also just say that it's always a good idea for them to reach out to their local health district and just see how they're planning within their area, but we will get the consistent response for that and send that out to each of you.
Okay, that would be great, and that'll help me share this with the DD community pretty widely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that, Lucy. Thank you for bringing that up. I think in the 1A, phase 1A, it lists residential care staff, and then in parentheses, it says DBHDS, and that was something we were really advocating for, to ensure that settings that are licensed by DBHDS are included in that 1A. And whether or not in the vaccination prioritization guidelines, that reference to residential care facilities and DBHDS means that it is those licensed settings, those congregate settings, as well as the staff who work there. So that is a little bit unclear. So that would be helpful. Thank you.
Messaging is what we're hearing back from a lot of here down here in Norfolk with the essential workers and even the medical staff is when we'll have an idea if someone has tested positive before, when there will be a decision, I know, on both the BDH and CDC, it's kind of vague. That's something for messaging. If you tested before, should you get the vaccine? And if you tested positive for COVID-19, whether you should get the test or not.
Hi, Michael, it's Kristen again. This is where my filling in for Stephanie is not that beneficial to you all, but hopefully she's going to join us here shortly. But again, I can take that question back and we can mail out the response to each of you all so that we have a clear answer there. I know as it pertains, you know, CDC was originally saying that you shouldn't vaccinate someone with an infection in the prior 90 days. So I think we'll just ensure where we sit with that and provide that communication to each of you all.
Hi, this is Judy Hopper with the Virginia Assisted Living Association, VALA. I know to that point, the governor had said that, you know, he had tested positive, but he was still planning on getting the vaccine. So that could be, you know, a testimonial, I guess, that could be included on the communications that he was going to be doing it. On a side note, just want to make sure that the communications, to make sure we hit as many of the caregiving staff as possible in the Commonwealth. If we could have all of the agencies that license, certify, register any of the caregivers to send out a common messaging, such as those that would go to CNAs, RMAs, LPNs, doctors, et cetera, including DSS, to license like assisted living communities and VDH. If we can make sure to have the same messaging going out from all of those agencies in order to encourage as many of the caregivers to be vaccinated as possible.
This is Doug Gray. I really like the idea of doing more around picking the right folks and making a plan to publicly show people getting the vaccine. The governor's a great start, but you know, rural communities, you're going to want a leader in their rural community, and so on. And so I think to some extent, if you want to use leaders that are not in 1A, for example, you're going to have to provide some cover to those folks to provide that assistance by to send a message to their different communities, particularly, you know, I mean, the surveys show that rural Republicans are the most resistant. So, for example, you'd want to get rural Republican leaders to get the injection on camera in the rural parts of Virginia. They won't take it if it appears that they're getting, you know, some sort of special treatment. It has to be part of the plan. And I think there's an opportunity there. And it's not just political leaders, but medical leaders too. But I think we can kind of plan out beyond just the governor. The legislature would be a good place to start. I think local political elected good officials too, because people need to see somebody that they relate to.
Hi, this is Anna from the Office of Health Equity. I also just wanted to piggyback on what Mr. Gray was saying, or Dr. Gray, that we need to make sure that we are impressing that both doses need to be done. We're hearing some Republican politicians, not in Virginia, but around, saying that, you know, you only need the first dose. And I think we need to make it very clear that, you know, you need to have both doses. And then also the side effects list, it shows that the second dose is worse for side effects than the first. That's what I saw for both Pfizer and Moderna. So I don't know what messaging could be important there, but there's been some scare tactics and some misinformation that I've come across. And I just want to be sure that people understand that, you know, like we need to show, I think that we need to make sure that they're seeing both injections being taken. And
hey, Anna, this is Stephanie. I think one of the things that we've talked about, and I'd love to you know, get some feedback on, is on our website to kind of try to use some of the misinformation and debunk those falsehoods and provide the clinical and the scientific data behind, you know, whatever that misinformation is.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think what concerned me the most was that it was leadership that was doing it. I wasn't worried about it, and I thought that was sufficient, but I think, I don't know if we need to amp things up a bit.
This is Carolyn Moneymaker. Can you all hear me now?
You can.
Oh, good, fine. I've got about three contraptions going here. One thing I really think that the communications and messaging committee, in addition to, you know, healthcare workers and which long-term care workers, et cetera, I really think they should also start giving clear information to the general public about just what Anna was saying about the need for two doses, the need for, you know, it be the same vaccine. And thirdly, that there will be some side effects to the shot, that it's normal. Because I had to take Uber today, and I was talking to a couple of Uber drivers, and they didn't know any of these things. And one of them even said, I wish, you know, somebody would explain this out for everybody to understand. So that, Stephanie, that's one thing I would take back to communications, is they need broad scale education, clear education of general Virginians, because there's a lot of fear. When people say side effects, they don't realize it's side effects of the vaccine, which are temporary. They're thinking it's more long-term side effects. So I think that would be something that would be good and will be a barrier to people getting the vaccine if they don't know these little education points.
Another point that I wanted to say is that we can also use this as a way to sort of say we need to support and make sure that we don't overwhelm the hospitals, because a lot of these providers that are getting vaccinated are going to have a day of downtime. So that could potentially make these hospitals, you know, shorthanded during the holidays while they're getting vaccinated. But that, you know, I think that maybe expressing that as well, like some people didn't even think about that, why we're so worried about the hospitals becoming overwhelmed, and the vaccine and the fact that, you know, 50% of people get body aches and headaches and need to rest after they take it is something to consider.
This is Allison Baracco. It would be nice if the group could tease out a little more. I know the adverse reaction rate is 50 to 60%. I was fortunate enough to be one of those vaccinated yesterday. I recognize I'll get my next one in 3 weeks, and we'll see what the side effects are like. But so far, I just have a sore arm, and it's not preventing me from working. I think it'll take time, but once we get more data to learn what exact percentage of employees will need to kind of rest or stay home, it'll be useful guidance. But our hospital is trying to schedule people like before they have a day off or two, so in case they do have those symptoms.
This is Stuart Hinakowitz. So they talk about a 60% adverse reaction rate in the active group. What was it in the placebo group? Hello?
I don't have that data in front of me, Stuart, but we can look at it.
I bet you it's high, is what I'm saying. You know, when you say 60% at 60% first reaction, sounds even. Comparison between that and the placebo.
Hey, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Also, people need to know that it's not all, you know, just black and white, that you'll either feel no effects, or it's like a bell-shaped curve. You know, you might be like Ms. Baracco and have just a sore arm. You might be like somebody else. You might have a little more. And I think that's another thing that people should understand as well. And we too schedule down at King's Daughters, we're giving the vaccines, and we've tried to schedule based on people's time off and that sort of thing.
Hey, Stephanie, this is Doug Gray. I had a question from providers about, after we, as we go down past 1A, because of how the vaccines have to be stored, is it that the other providers are going to end up going to hospitals? They'll continue to run clinics to do it rather than come to their practices, given the storage problems? But they're asking that type of question. But I don't know how you answer it if you don't have the answer. But just thought I would share that.
Yeah, so I mean, as far as the prioritization beyond that, I think that the two things that we can share is one is that we expect that potentially this week when ACIP meets, that they will provide some guidance on phase 1B and 1C. So we'll have that. And then after that, then we will go through that prioritization phase again, where we'll have to define that more specifically. So I think that it could be very likely that we have information early next week on a little bit more information on the prioritization.
Thanks.
I did want to emphasize that the immunization registry does have will have that ability to remind people of that second dose, so it will do that. So if it's entered in there, then it will provide that reminder. So that's one thing. Two is everybody will get a vaccine report card, so with the second dose. And then I do think that as in the chat, it was pointed out that there will be providers who have already an internal system that they use to remind people of second doses, but that is in the Virginia Immunization Registry.
What about those people who aren't, providers who aren't on VIS yet, the registry? A lot of the adult providers aren't on it.
In order to be a provider and administer vaccine, you're going to have to be on this. But even outside of that, if as a patient, you can get that information.
Okay.
I think. I don't want to misspeak.
I know that when we're in the office, we, in the pediatric office, we print out this for people, but I don't know, I've never heard of anybody, a layperson going in.
So, yeah, the layperson would not go into VIS, but if we have their phone numbers, then it will have the capability of provide the messaging out for them.
Okay, good. When will the providers who have signed intent to give COVID vaccine, are they required to sign up for VIS right then, or is that going to come down the road later, or what?
I thought that was part of the intent.
I will tell you that that's what I had to do when I had to sign up for that, for this, when I registered my intent.
Okay. Because most pediatricians who give up VVFC vaccines, they have to be on VIS, so that's not a barrier for us. I know we've already skipped in the agenda the part about the Immunize Virginia survey, but I would like for all of you to take a look at the survey, complete it yourself, and make sure that people in your organization that you represent, that you make this survey available to them, because the more data we can get, the better it is. So all of you,
hey, Carolyn, I just wanted to call out that not everyone in here is a provider. Right. So the target audience for the survey
is healthcare providers. Yes.
I'm not sure that. I mean, maybe, but I'm not sure, because in the advisory work group we have, you know, community membership as well as.
Yeah, that's the same here. We're not, the Virginia Board's not a provider.
I'm an epidemiologist with the health department, so I'm not a provider either.
This is Michelle Taylor. I'm not a provider either, but I just wanted you to know that I sent it out to all of our free clinics. Yesterday or Monday, I think it was, so that they could fill it out and have their providers, you know, in their free clinic fill it out.
Thank you. Maybe that's how I should have framed my comment, is anybody, any of you who have have contact with provider groups like you do, could send it out and get as much data as we can. Thank you for doing that, Michelle.
So I think when we put this agenda together, we put in on the third bullet, obtaining consent within long-term care facilities. And I see Dr. Baracco's question in the chat, so I'm just going to read it. Are we going to dive into long-term care consent more? We have some low-income facilities with multiple residents that are estranged from family and may not have an active guardian. So I think that's a good point. And we have asked for a little bit more clarification, and we're waiting for the long-term care toolkit from the CDC, which will have a consent form in there and specific questions about, you know, in these situations where someone may not be able to consent and that the inability to maybe reach someone who can provide that consent, how that should be handled. So I don't know that we have that information, but I think it's a good point, Dr. Baracco. I do want to, you know, certainly make everyone aware that the federal pharmacy partnerships, that they are working in ahead of time to get those consent forms before they're on site, so that way that and so they're providing those in advance, and then that consent would not be required necessarily in a setting outside of those.
That's helpful. We're on the Central Shenandoah Health District. We have collaborated with all the long-term care facilities, and we have meetings, and those are kind of their FAQs for us. And to even be able to let them know a CDC toolkit is on the way, I think will be meaningful.
Yeah, it is. We're hoping that'll be out any day. So we are expecting that.
Great. Thank you.
And I did want to say that the long-term care task force is meeting tomorrow, and we're going to talk about that. So, but I do think it's a very helpful point, and we need to, and we're watching for that. And as soon as it's available, we'll put it on our website. Many questions going on about the consent form, and particularly within those settings.
Stephanie, when you talk about under bullet 5 about identifying folks who are not mobile and at high risk. That would be people, for example, who would be living in their own homes and not particularly connected with a group. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've talked a little bit, and really this was in previous conversations, but about, you know, the use of vans or mobile units to go into communities. But I think even in general, reaching out to people that may not have that ability or that may be very homebound. And so it's just a conversation as we continue to talk. I don't know that we ever came up with anything specific, but I just kind of kept it on there if it was something that I saw was coming up multiple times or had come up recently.
Yeah, and this is Terry Morgan. I would like to add to that group people who live in their own homes or apartments, who have disabilities, who do receive services in the community. They're not in a congregate setting. You know, I, for example, have a friend who has cerebral palsy and receives services, has somebody who comes into his home and helps him, and went over to see him this past Sunday, and he wasn't doing well. He had a fever and he had a bad cough, and got in contact with his support coordinator. And he went to the hospital and he tested positive, got the positive test yesterday. And I think that there's a lot of people who have people coming into their home, but they're not in a congregate facility, who are definitely at higher risk. I'm concerned about them, actually, who are a part of that group, who aren't necessarily mobile and don't have, you know, easy access to testing and some of the supports they may need, and are at higher risk of negative impacts from the virus.
Thank you. Something that we definitely need to think through if we have ideas of how to, you know, connect with this community, then we want to do that. So certainly working with home health.
Yeah, and also with the Department of Medical Assistance Services, they manage the CCC Plus waiver, which, yeah, everybody who's on that waiver has a nursing facility level of care. So they have that medical nursing need, and many live in their own homes and have those supports who come into their home. They're not in a congregate facility, but they are at higher risk and aren't in the 1A priority, but are at risk.
So this is Lee Grossman. So I don't know how we do this, but every licensed care provider has a roster of patients that they're responsible for, per this question about how to get to folks that are cared for in their own homes or in smaller settings. And one would hope that wherever they're receiving their primary care, that is where they would receive either the flu vaccine or the COVID vaccine. Or that person would be responsible for somehow making that happen. But that is, again, going to put the onus on the PCP for that individual.
Is there any way that, you know, we all licensed primary care providers or any kind of health-related provider, they have their own, like we have medicine, has Board of Medicine, Board of Pharmacy, whatever. Is there a way that BDH could ask these boards to send out this kind of reminder that Lee is talking about, where they would be reminded to try to pull up their rosters and get in touch with people on their list that, you know, like they usually go after them for the flu vaccine, they could also somehow message them for the COVID vaccine, because we're always, at least in Board of Medicine, we're always getting little updates or whatever, and it'd be nice if the boards, because they have the lists of their licensees, and they could do, like Lee was saying, they could remind the providers to do this in a non-threatening way, just a helpful way. I think that that might be good as well, and it would reach all us and the healthcare people all across.
So Carolyn, when we send out our clinicians' letters, our commissioners' letters, those go to DHP licensees.
You don't think that getting a reminder from your licensing board might get your attention as well? Because sometimes we're all getting such a flood of incoming emails. And it's just like you see the Board of Medicine, for example, pop up, you open it.
Yeah, I guess we'd have to talk to DHP about their ability and willingness to message on their end. I thought that you were... it was a matter of getting it disseminated.
It's just a thought, because I just worry about some of these people. They're elderly, they live alone. Maybe they're not getting any services because they don't really need any services. So I'm just afraid of them going down between the cracks.
Hello, everyone. This is Stephanie had to unexpectedly step away and said that she would be right back. Are there any other questions or considerations that the panelists would like to share?
Another possible avenue to identify people who are at risk, who are not mobile necessarily, might be the health plans. I know with the CCC Plus waiver and the developmental disabilities waiver, the health plans provide care coordination, and those care coordinators are connected and know and can identify maybe relatively quickly those who may be at most risk and be targeted for those vaccines and have that outreach specifically to those individuals. So I think the health plans may have a role to play. I know at the beginning of the pandemic, the health plans and the care coordinators did identify people who were most vulnerable, especially if their in-home supports didn't show up, and tried to make sure that there was some, some backup strategy in place for folks. So I think they might be a good avenue just to help identify individuals who meet this category and might need some additional outreach to make sure they have access. And when I refer to health plans, I'm talking specifically about the health plans who participate in Medicaid and managing those long-term care services and supports.
What was the question?
That was my comment was around barriers and individuals who are maybe not mobile and at high risk, and how to identify those individuals.
Yeah, I think the plans are going to identify people at the highest risk via the data that they have about their conditions and other criteria.
Mm-hmm.
As it gets to their turn, the problem we have is if they're not in a facility, and our efforts in long-term care to try to keep them out of facilities in many cases, it does make it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The temperature requirement.
Yeah.
That's the problem at the beginning. I think at some point, that's what I was asking earlier, when we start to move to one B and one C, it's clear that some locations will be and that's partially because first drug comes in those amounts. The second one comes in smaller amounts. But eventually, I guess we're going to have to develop teams to go out, just like you know, CVS and Walgreens are doing to facilities. The problem is it's going to have to be much more organized because, you know, it's going to be much more busy.
You faded a little bit, Doug, so I'm not sure if I caught everything that you said, but one unique aspect of the health plans with the population I'm referring to is that they actually provide those services. They're the payer of the services for personal assistance services through the waivers. So they know exactly who these folks are and can be instrumental. You know, the people who have chosen to receive their services in the community versus an institutional setting, and the health plans are providing those services, paying for those services. So they know who those folks are.
Yeah, I think the hard part is figuring out how to get this scene to them. I mean, we know who they are, where they are. At some point, we'll develop that capacity. And now, we don't really have the capacity. We have staff that could go do it, or we could arrange for them to do it. If we had vaccine that was not, you know, required to be super stored and in short
right.
supply. So we're going to get there.
I'm sorry, you may have said that and I missed it. You're fading out a little bit, your audio, so I might have missed a little bit of what you said.
Sorry, I'm trying to be as loud as I can. So.
That's okay. That's okay.
So do we have some next steps that or anything that we need to bring back to? So we have our advisory work group, our larger advisory work group meeting on Monday, the 21st. So if there's anything we need to take back there, of course, we'll report out on some of on information as of this point. But and then anything for our next meeting. And then we need to establish when we think we need to should meet again. And we're getting into probably a tough couple of weeks to be able to find meeting times, but I'll be here. I'll be working on vaccination units. So I think that, you know, I need some help with you all helping set the cadence for our next meeting. Do you think as we move into other priority populations, there will be some good conversations that we'll be able to have as we move forward?
Yes, sure.
So I could propose that we meet in 3 weeks, Carolyn and Stuart. I don't know if you all have any thoughts that would put us meeting Wednesday, January 6th.
Well, hold on a second. Let me look at that.
It's okay for me.
Anybody else have any?
It's good for me. It's good for me.
Okay. So I will follow up with minutes. From this meeting, and hopefully we'll see you on the webinar or call on Monday, the 21st, and then we'll meet again as a sub work group on Wednesday, January 6th, 2021.
Stephanie, one thing I do think we need to bring to the main work group is our discussion today on the long-term health care facilities, getting their vaccines, the patients, and all of these. We've talked about these barriers for people who live at home and that sort of thing, because once we bring it out, people in the major group may have ideas.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, I'll compile it all and send it, and we can report that out. And hopefully have some robust conversation, and we'll and we can keep thinking about it. And as I get more information, then sending that out. So that sounds like a good plan, Carolyn. Thank you. All right. Well, on that note, I hope to see and talk to many of you on Monday. Have a good rest of the week.
You too, Stephanie. Try to rest a little.
Hey, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Yes, thank you.